Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good martinis today for conservatives. And Jim, after perhaps the most depressing start to a week in the history of this podcast, we've actually got a serious amount of good news for conservatives. It feels good to kind of shift things in the opposite direction.
We needed it.
To say the least. All right. Good martini number one. Hillary Clinton's numbers continue to tank. This according to an Associated Press GFK poll. Overall, her favorability ratings are down to 39%. Her unfavorables hovering around 50%. And then when you get into specific character traits here, Jim, it actually gets even better when you look at Hillary's numbers compared to when she announced the first time back in April. Only 48% think that she's competent. That was not asked back in April. 47% think she's decisive. That's down 9 points in just 3 months. Likeability down 3 points to 41%. A compassionate, not asked the first time. That's only at 40%. 7% loss on the issue of whether she's inspiring. Only 37% think she is. And despite Hillary Clinton saying, "I'm honest, people can trust me," in her interview with CNN, she's lost another 6 points in that category. Only 31% think she's honest. And even some Democrats in the story that accompanies this poll say they're just completely unimpressed with her evasive manner of dodging tough questions about the email scandal and other things. And really, Jim, other than her not running, this is about as good of a start to this campaign as we could hope for.
Yeah, and it's not unbelievably stunning. I mean, we kind of knew that there was going to be a drop in her numbers once she stopped being the relatively, you know, I'm not going to say nonpartisan, let's just say less partisan role of Secretary of State. She got into the rough and tumble of politics and, you know, started being a more partisan figure. What I think is most encouraging is that everything that we who don't like her point out, look, she's dishonest and she will lie to your face and she'll offer a lie that she, and you'll know that she's lying and she'll still do it anyway, i.e., I was never subpoenaed, as she said in the CNN interview. Well, that's doing some damage. These are really not so great numbers. And the only, you know, kind of silver lining she can take from this is that Republicans have pretty bad numbers, too. There's really nobody who's doing particularly well in terms of favorability. Kind of intriguing just how little some folks like Scott Walker are unknown to the national electorate. So there's potential there. Some of them, like Jeb Bush and in particular Donald Trump, name ID pretty darn high. I think Trump was up to about 88% people having an opinion on him. It's going to be interesting to see if anybody can change those numbers or get a more favorable impression. My sense is that campaigns do not make candidates more likable. They do not build support. They actually make them less likable and less favorable because of all the attack ads going back and forth. But if you're a Democrat, I think you got reason to sweat here. I think that in addition to all the traditional challenges of trying to keep the White House after 8 years of having one party, ultimately, they appear determined to nominate a figure who is not seen as honest and trustworthy, not likable, and just overall, people are not having quite the same faith in her that they may have had about a year ago.
All good news, and it's obviously early, but as you just said, campaigns over time, perhaps those numbers will get even worse, and that should be good news for the eventual Republican nominee, but of course, whoever that is going to have to sift through 16 other primary challengers, so that could get a little bruising as well. All right, on to the bad martini now, and yesterday the president held a press conference basically designed to make sure that he could get all his talking points out there on the Iran deal, because there's a lot of Democrats that still are not very happy with what they're seeing so far. So Joe Biden's up on the Hill and Barack Obama did his press conference yesterday and he got fairly straight questions, some of them softballs, until he got to Major Garrett from CBS News, who actually asked two really tough questions. The one we're going to focus on here is the one that's getting a lot of attention. And that was Major Garrett being the first person to finally ask how the four Americans held in Iran factored into this deal, because it appears, based on what we know so far, that they didn't factor in at all.
As you well know, there are four Americans in Iran, three held on trumped-up charges, according to your administration, one whereabouts unknown. Can you tell the country, sir, why you are content with all the fanfare around this deal to leave the conscience of this nation and the strength of this nation unaccounted for in relation to these four Americans?
I got to give you credit, Major, for how you craft those questions. For the notion that I'm content as I celebrate with American citizens languishing in Iranian jails, Major, that's nonsense. And you should know better. I've met with the families of some of those folks. Nobody's content. And our diplomats and our teams are working diligently to try to get them out.
Later, Garrett said his question was intended to be provocative because there had been no official pronouncement about how the hostages at all factored into this. So, Jim, what you can't see there is Obama looking at Garrett in that moment of silence there as he was trying to formulate his answer. It almost looked like he wished Major Garrett was languishing in a prison somewhere.
Well, look, it's not like this administration has mentioned Fox News journalists in Department of Justice cases. And it's not like they've, you know, wiretapped AP, Associated Press reporters. Right? Right? Yeah. If you want to object to the wording of it, you know, like Obama could object to the implication that, you know, it's not fair to say he doesn't care about these reporters. Although I don't think it's an unbelievably unfair conclusion, considering how these guys have been in prison for a long time. It seems pretty clear these guys have been in an Iranian prison as a deliberate move by the Iranian government to get a bargaining chip, to get a form of leverage against us. And there's no indication that this really became a serious point in negotiations. And, you know, Obama kept saying, well, you know, if it's a bad deal is worse than no deal and we're not afraid to walk away from the table. Well, why not? How much worse would it be if we had demanded the release of these four for the rest of the deal, considering all the other concessions we made? You know, Obama can complain a bit about the wording of it or the implication that he doesn't care, whine. But it's an extremely fair question of how this administration can call this a success when it did nothing on this. And you'd kind of think that, you know, stop unjustly imprisoning our people would be a fairly basic, demand of us. And you know, it kind of just further, you know, indicates a sense that, look, this was a complete capitulation on our part. We did not get anything. And the suspicion is the Iranians deliberately didn't want to release these guys because their next negotiation is going to be a full restoration of diplomatic relations with the United States. That they want more, and thus they didn't want to give up this bargaining chip too early. And again, it'd be nice to have an American president who resented the hell out of the Iranians using American citizens as bargaining chips. I guess you could say for the Iranians, old habits die hard. This is what started U.S.-Iranian troubles back in the late 70s. This technically is our bad martini in terms of Obama's reaction. I think it actually probably still qualifies as a makeup good martini for earlier in the week. And then, you know, look, Garrett was brave enough to answer the question and to put it in a way that really you could tell got under Obama's skin. And I think it's a very fair one. Like, how can you say this is a good deal when, you know, in the realm of centrifuges and nuclear programs and nuclear bases and inspections and military bases, hostages are considered one of the smaller items to deal with, and it's a very simple, easy, measurable thing. You know, you have our guys in prison, you let them go. And the president and his negotiating team didn't want to make that a precondition for anything further agreements. And I think that's kind of revealing that ultimately the president can talk a good game about how, oh, they're working so hard and so diligently. Yada. Well, look, you know, for all that hard work, we're not seeing any results.
The fact that he didn't mention it at all in his Tuesday morning announcement, say something, even if it's fairly wishy-washy, but he never even brought it up, and neither did Kerry until Major Garrett finally brought it up yesterday.
I want to emphasize to all Americans, you are not forgotten. What's his name? And the other guy? And the other two guys?
Yeah. Most wounding tweet I saw in this earlier today was, at least Jimmy Carter tried to get the hostages back.
Ooh, ow. Ow.
So... all right, on to the third martini, and this one is definitely good and about time. This is from Hot Air and Gabriel Mailor. The long unraveling of the so-called John Doe 2 investigation, convened by partisan district attorneys in Wisconsin, is now complete. This case was about using vague campaign finance rules to intimidate conservative groups and smear Republican officials, including Governor Scott Walker. No charges were filed in the John Doe 2 investigation, and it was halted by both the state and federal courts. Here's the Wisconsin Supreme Court statement. To be clear, this conclusion ends the John Doe investigation because the special prosecutor's legal theory is unsupported in either reason or law. Consequently, the investigation is closed, consistent with our decision and the order entered by Reserve Judge Peterson. We order that the special prosecutor and the district attorneys involved in this investigation must cease all activities related to the investigation, return all property seized in the investigation from any individual or organization, and permanently destroy all copies of information and other materials obtained through the investigation. And for those who followed the story, they were trying to allege there was collusion back in the 2010 campaign. There were stories recently about raids on homes of innocent people just because they supported Scott Walker, especially as it related to collective bargaining. So just as Scott Walker gets in the race, the liberals lose to him again, Jim.
That's a really good way of putting it, Greg. If you've been reading National Review Online and a couple other good places, they've done some great coverage of this. If I call it the Inquisition, it's probably a little hyperbolic, but not completely out of line, because much like the Inquisition, no one expected the Spanish Inquisition. No one expected this kind of full-on legal full-court press against people who were supporters of Scott Walker, under the idea that people who were not on his campaign and people who were part of independent organizations were colluding. Is that something that you're supposed to get into? I suppose so, although I think that, you know, most people think campaign finance laws are now something of a joke, and that, you know, it's not surprising that right-of-center people in two different organizations are going to support each other the same way that independent labor unions are totally independent of the Democratic Party, right? But what you had was a bunch of Democratic prosecutors who basically decided we're going to go after these guys. And as you said, SWAT team raids going into people's houses. This appeared to be from step by step to be done as a way to intimidate as much as humanly possible. There are drug dealers who get, you know, service of warrants and stuff like that, you know, people kicking down the doors. And then the next thing was gag rules of saying, look, you know, you kind of have this feeling, okay, I thought there was a First Amendment. You know, the police knock down my door, they come in, they start searching my place. I'm allowed to say, hey, this is ridiculous. This is outrageous. Under the rules of this one, they kept saying, no, there's a gag rule in effect. If you talk about the police coming to your house, you're under arrest. You violated a court order. And it just seemed to be this completely un-American, out-of-control prosecutor. The other amazing thing is they kept losing in the court. And they kept basically being like, no, there's no evidence you generated here of any sort of illegal collusion. And even if you did, it doesn't justify, you know, the sort of tactics you'd use for, you know, going after El Chapo or something like that. You'd think they were going after violent criminals in light of the way they were doing these things. Our David French had some very good reporters and talking to people, and people who seemed in Wisconsin law enforcement who seemed to realize they were being used as a political cudgel here. Anyway, the good news today is the Supreme Court has basically really slammed down on this 4-2 decision. One judge had to recuse himself. It is pretty clear, like, they terminated it with prejudice, might be a good way of putting it. I mean, they really came out and said, unsupported in reason is a really harsh way of describing this case. And it basically means, the good news is this has been stopped. The better news is now obviously there's a pretty strong case to be made against abuse of power charges against these prosecutors. This is, on the one hand, a runaway government. It does kind of indicate just how strong the unhinged fury of liberals in Wisconsin has become. If you're feeling warm and fuzzy towards Scott Walker, maybe that's a good indicator. Is this guy going to be tough enough for the presidency? Well, he certainly has taken on a vociferous, frothing-at-the-mouth opposition in his home state. This Supreme Court case seemingly seems to open the door towards at least a federal civil rights lawsuit or some other lawsuits to efforts to get civil damages against these prosecutors and, you know, maybe even criminal charges for abuse of power.
Yeah, let's hope so. Constitutional rights absolutely obliterated, as you said. So good week for Scott Walker. I think the left is now, 0-4 against him? Three elections and this now?
Hoping for 0-6, right?
Exactly right. Wow. Well, Jim, you're going to be gone from this podcast until a week from Monday because you're headed out on the National Review cruise. Have a great time. I'm sure you're looking forward to good conversation and good wildlife. And there isn't an election that just happened. So hopefully everyone's nice and relaxed and having a great time.
Everybody's feeling good. Well, yeah, I'm sure, I'm going to bring up the Republican primary on the board. And if you hear about a cruise ship having to pull into port because of huge fights on board, that might be foreshadowing the state of the Republican primary to come.
Do you mean huge fights?
Huge fights. Yeah, actually, that'll be an interesting name to mention on board. And we'll see what happens. It's a huge boat, Greg. Huge. Anyway, best to you and whoever my replacement guest host is. And I will see you a week from Monday.
Sounds great. Have a safe trip. Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And tune in again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.